history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told. If we'll take a little time to ask some questions and listen, we're going to learn a lot. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that way, yeah, we are amazed. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know we're going to learn a lot today because we're with Mr. Julesberg. We're in Julesberg, Colorado, with a gentleman who's lived here his whole life, except for when Uncle Sam put him on a ship in the Pacific Ocean. Lee Kaiser, 92 years old. And I got to try to explain where we're sitting here, Lee, because this is the old Ford Garage Museum. How long have you operated this place?
Well, I never did have the Ford agency. Right. I got the hold of the building after they built the new Ford Garage on the west end of town. And I had this collection in different places. After I got hold of the building, I put this together probably 50 years ago.
Well, I know the word has gotten around, and that's how I found out about you. I had someone who had stopped through send me an email, say, hey, you got to go to Julesberg, Colorado, and find Lee Kaiser. And the first thing I had to do was look at a map and figure out where Julesberg, Colorado was. Bet that's not the first time you've heard that over the years.
No, it's quite often I heard that.
So when you hear someone say, where's Julesberg, Colorado, how do you explain it? What's your description of where you are on the map?
In the northeast corner of the state of Colorado, pushed up against Nebraska on the north and Nebraska on the east, and we're on the map. And also on the original Lincoln Highway. This is the first town that the Pony Express in Colorado was the only one. And then the Union Pacific Railroad came through in 1867.
And I know you know the history of this town. You've lived a lot of the history of this town. And when I say the old Ford Garage Museum, this isn't just cars. You have some beauties out there. There are Model A's and Model T's. There are touring cars. You even have a Buick out there. I don't know how that snuck through the door, but the historic antique gas pumps and the photos and memorabilia on the walls. You've got every newspaper going back to the 1930s or something?
Yes, I do, along with 745 Life magazines from World War II.
And is it true that one of those Life magazines even has your photo in it?
Yes, it does. Believe it or not, it's the famous photo of the sailor kissing the girl in Times Square. Yeah. But back farther in the magazine, Life magazine put on a show in Pearl Harbor. We came in with wounded Marines. Life magazine put this program on. It's called a luau. They took a lot of pictures, and they're in the back of that particular magazine, August 15th, 1945.
Well, you're going to show that to me before I leave, right?
Yes.
That way I'll put it online at hometownheroesradio.com and everybody can find it. Well, we're going to get to how you ended up in the Navy and what you did in the Navy and more about what you have here at this museum, which I hope everybody listening will find a way to get to if they're on that historic Lincoln Highway. You also have World War II memorabilia here, a whole part of the museum dedicated to that. But tell me about growing up in this small town along the railroad and the old Pony Express route. What was your childhood like here?
Well, my grandparents and parents were all railroaders. We came here in the early years with the railroad. My father was and grandfather was transferred up and down the railroad according to seniority. You could always bump somebody who had more seniority, and that's the reason why we lived in a few towns. But once we got here, my dad said he was in 10 different grade schools in his lifetime, and he wasn't going to move his family anymore, so we stayed here. And this is where I grew up at.
And I bet it's hard for you to imagine anything else. You're probably thankful your dad said, hey, I don't want him to go through what I went through.
We all got an education, not only in Julesberg, but all my children, for example. I've got 7 degrees from the University of Colorado.
But I'm sure you couldn't fathom all of that when you're growing up here in Julesberg. So take me back there. What kind of chores did you have to do as a kid?
Cleaning chicken houses, cleaning milk sheds, doing anything to make a few bucks. It actually was only pennies at that time.
Well, we're sitting right next to your historic barber chair. You cut hair here for 68 years. I'm sure you made a few bucks in that chair.
Yes. Yes, I did pretty well. But I also got into real estate after number of years, I had about 50% of the buildings on the main street of Julesburg. It's one of the probably the nicest little towns of anywhere around. We have a tremendous reputation of educating our children. Almost everybody has an education beyond high school, and we're proud of that fact. Very little crime.
So as a child, oldest of four kids, you told me what some of the chores were. But what about your dreams, your ambitions? When you were around playing or something, you said, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do.
You have a lot of dreams as you grow up, and you don't always know what you want to do. I did not come from a family of means, so lots of times you just take whatever you got going for you at the time and try to expound on it.
Since you are the historian of this place and you preserve so much history in Julesburg just in this museum, you were here during the Great Depression. Was the Depression felt in this town?
Oh, yes. Depression was bad for everybody. Nobody had any money. And especially the guys that are a little bit older than me, the older World War II guys, you couldn't have asked for any tougher men to fight a war than what those boys were. I often think about if we hadn't been brought up during that Depression year, it would have taken us longer to win World War II, because they were seasoned veterans from the time they were just kids.
So it sounds like it was a tough life. Do you have some illustrations of things you remember during that time that you look back on now and say, yeah, that was real difficult?
Well, of course, we had the WPA, the NRA, different things, programs. And that was just to keep the young men occupied and not necessarily that they were going to get in trouble or anything, but to keep the young guys doing something. The CCC camps and so forth.
Did you guys always have enough to eat?
Yes, but it's only because our parents were fluent in cooking and so forth. But lots of times we were short on food, but then our mothers were such good cooks that they could make a meal out of anything.
Well, I know you would have been pretty young, if I'm doing the math, when Pearl Harbor happened. You would have been, I guess, just a 16-year-old. But do you remember December 7th of 41?
Very clearly. We had a little ball game going on in a vacant lot right west of where our house was. All of a sudden, somebody come running out and says, "We've been bombed, we've been bombed." And somebody said, "Well, where?" And they said, "Well, Pearl Harbor." And of course they said, "Well, where in the world is Pearl Harbor?"
And I guess you probably found out pretty quickly. And did you see things changing right after that?
Immediately. The lady next door to us had a boy in the Navy. He graduated out of high school in 36 up here. Nothing to do during the Depression, so he joined the Navy. A month before Pearl Harbor, he was on the USS Arizona. A month before Pearl Harbor, he was transferred to the cruiser USS Houston. Well, we know what happened to the Arizona. He missed that. He went down in the South China Sea. A shore battery hit the ship, and three sailors was killed, and he was one of them. Then 1 month later, the cruiser Houston went down into around Guadalcanal, and they got in between two battleships, and they blew her all to pieces. And there was very few survivors on it. What few survivors were sent to build the bridge of River Kwai. And to finish the story, we were playing ball again 2 weeks later, and when the mother got the telegram from the depot that her son, Glenn Wise, was killed on the Houston.
So even in a small town in the corner of Colorado, the war brought death to this small town.
Yes, it did.
And at what point did you start to think, you know, if this keeps going, I may end up being a part of this at some point?
Well, of course, the feeling at that time, he said, this thing will be over in 6 weeks. He said, there's no way that there can be an America. Well, we found out that wasn't true. It was a long, hard-fought war.
Yeah, and you're scheduled to graduate high school here in 1944, and I guess I should mention that. I understand for high school around here to field sports teams, you have to combine with the neighboring town. Is that right?
Not then, but we do now. We're combined with two other smaller towns.
Back then, those were your rivals?
No, we were different classifications. Six-man, and we played 11-man football.
Did you play any of those sports in high school?
Yes, I played all the sports. Football, basketball, and track. I was a sprinter, and I also was a swimmer in World War II for the downed pilots. But the reason why, because we'd been in shape for track. Us 18, 19-year-old kids were the best in shape.
So, but you're 18, and starting your senior year of high school, you were probably thinking of other things besides putting a uniform on, huh? What did you think you were going to go to college, or did you figure you were going to get drafted?
There was no question where we were going to go. Everybody volunteered as many as they could, but the reason why we didn't leave school is because we wanted to get at least get our high school diploma. And this wonderful superintendent of schools that we had, Elizabeth Zorn, made sure that we had our diplomas by the time that we were left.
So she cut a deal with the draft board?
She did. She cut a deal with the draft board, and they went along with it. As soon as we were 18, we were going to go. And she said, well, hold off until I get them graduated, which is only 5 months. And they said, all right, we'll hold off until you get them. But you haven't graduated by three guys left, kids left right after the New Year's. And then some of us left a couple months later.
And how many were in your graduating class here?
35.
So tell me how you ended up in the Navy.
Well, when you take your examination at the New Custom Building in Denver, they give you your examination, and then they line you up. I don't know how they did anywhere else, but in that particular day, as we walked through that line, they said, Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, Army, Navy, Marines. And I just happened to land up in the Navy.
Boy, that's kind of crazy to think about, isn't it? That just that random pattern could determine someone's fate.
That's right. And all the kids in that area that got the Marines were all on Iwo Jima. But I was in the Navy, and I was at Iwo Jima too, but aboard ship.
So you're saying if you were one spot off in line, you would have been wearing a Marine Corps uniform and getting shot at on those beaches.
That's right. However, when we left boot camp, we all caught three destroyers in Bremerton, the Hull, the Spence, and the Monahan, and the Wilson. During the Leyte Gulf invasion, a month before that, Admiral Halsey was caught in the worst typhoon that ever hit the Pacific. We were supposed to be on the Hull, but the Hull and Spence and Monahan all capsized during that typhoon. The reason why they did is because they pumped their ballast off to take on fuel, and we were next to take on fuel. But we still had our balance. We were still sitting alone in the water.
Yeah, I've interviewed survivors from the Hull and the Monahan who survived that typhoon. Oh. Yeah, miraculously. So,
well, they would be my boot camp buddies, because that boot camp, out of that 150 in that boot camp, there was only five guys got schooling. All the rest of us went right aboard ships.
So I understand. What was the point at which you would have gone on one of those ships, and why did you go to the Wilson instead?
Because the guy before me was a Marine, so he went to Marines, and then I went to the Navy, and then so forth. It was just a matter of luck what ship we went on.
And what was your job aboard this destroyer, the Wilson?
I was a signalman, a striker. We didn't get school, so we'd pick out a group aboard ship that you thought that you'd like to be in. And I saw the signalman up there up on the bridge all the time, and looked like they were doing a really fantastic job of talking to everybody from other ships. And I thought, I asked if I could join their gang, and they did. They let me in.
Something tells me being out on the ocean is a lot different than taking a skinny dip in the North Platte River out here.
South Platte.
Oh, I'm on the wrong part of the Platte. South Platte River. But had you ever been on a ship before?
No. And Navy liked the Midwest kids, because they were easy to train. They didn't know what that ocean was like.
How did you take to it? Were there some moments that were kind of welcome to the Navy or welcome to life at sea moments for you?
I never did like the sea. The ship was rolled and tossed and up and down, and I was seasick a lot. Every time we'd go in the shore and stay a couple of days and get underway again, I'd become seasick again. But I survived it.
And to perform your duties as a signalman, what were the things that you had to know how to do and had to operate in those situations?
Well, it's like anybody that had scouting training, you learn the Morse code. I knew a little bit about the Morse code and was able to send signals before. And then, of course, that's what got me into the signal gang when I did have that background on the Boy Scouts.
So your signaling was all with lights, not with flags, semaphore, or anything?
Flags, lights, the lanyard signals. There was four lanyards, and you put different flags up there, and they all meant something. You had to read them with a long glass, 32-power long glass.
In this day and age, it's real easy to communicate. I mean, we've got these little computers in our pocket that can talk to Mars for all we know. But when you're out there at sea and you're the link between your ship and these other ships, was that a lot of responsibility for you?
Well, we were running radio silence. You couldn't use your radio, so everything was signal, flashing light.
Can you give me an example or two of the nature of some of the messages that you needed to communicate?
You'd address the fleet that you were in first, but you wouldn't name the ship, of course. Everything was in code. We'd read the code, mark it down, then we'd take it to the radio shack, and they would decode it. Then we'd give it to the captain.
So if you mess up, one little mistake can make a big difference.
Yeah. Well, we'd always double-check it to make sure that sometimes there would be two readers on it, but you just didn't make a mistake.
And how did an 18-year-old kid from Julesburg handle all that responsibility?
I was a go-getter. All the guys above me, they'd already been on the ship for 3, 4, 5 years. Some of them even put it in commission in 1939. I was towards the end of the war. My responsibilities was very limited.
And you mentioned being off of Iwo Jima. You guys also were there at Okinawa. That's where your ship got kamikazed. But what was the first taste of the war for you, where you saw or experienced something that made it real?
Well, that's where the suicide plane started, was at Lady Gulf. Well, I'll back off a little. There were suicides in the Philippines, too. In the Philippines, on the invasion of Mindoro, the biggest explosion outside the atomic bombs that was dropped happened in the ocean off of Mindoro. An ammunition ship blew up.
And you saw it?
I saw it. We were 5 miles away from it, and it broke the eardrums on some of the guys that was exposed to the direct sound of it.
Well, I know you would soon find yourself in some situations where more than just your eardrums were in danger. I don't think anybody's going to be able to guess what led to your teeth being knocked out in a kamikaze attack. It's time for a break now, but don't forget to check out the photos and videos online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And if you're going anywhere near northeastern Colorado, I promise you, a trip to Lee Kaiser's Old Ford Garage and Museum will be worth the trip. We'll hear more of what makes that statement so true when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.